A few moments later, they heard her get out of bed, and then her little face peered around the door. "Come on, love, back to bed," Elaine said gently. They resettled her in bed, and, giving her another kiss goodnight, came out and waited on the landing again. A minute or so passed, and then she reappeared. They took her back to bed again and again. Eventually, Ian said, "I don't think she can be tired. Let's take her down with us for a while." Downstairs, Anna quickly proved she was anything but tired, and now feeling more confident and perhaps realizing this was where she was going to live, she ran from room to room exploring, opening drawers and cupboards, peering under furniture and into corners, as she had in their hotel room. She picked up anything she liked the look of, including Elaine's glass and china ornaments, and clambered onto the furniture to get at objects she couldn't reach. There was so much more for her to see here than in the hotel room and the Stark orphanage. To begin with, Ian and Elaine laughed and indulged her. It was, after all, her first night. But by midnight, they were both exhausted and needed to go to bed themselves. "I've got to be up for work in the morning," Ian said. He'd used up all his annual leave on the adoption trips and had also taken some unpaid leave. "Anna, it's time for bed," Elaine said more firmly. Catching up with her in the hall, she took her up to bed. As Ian showered, Elaine tried to settle Anna, but each time she left her in her room, she came out. When Ian had finished in the bathroom, wrapped in his dressing gown, he came to help. But half an hour later, when Anna still hadn't settled, they decided to take her into their bed so they could hopefully all get some sleep. Anna didn't sleep even there, and at nearly 2 a.m., bone-weary, Elaine suggested they give her a spoonful of the sedative. "Just to help her settle tonight," she said, feeling guilty. It had been prescribed to help at the hotel and on the plane. There was a little left, and they hadn't anticipated using it once home.
"Yes, just for tonight, then," Ian agreed, yawning. "It won't harm her. It's 12 hours since she had the last dose."
Elaine took Anna downstairs, gave her a spoonful of the medicine, and then back up to their bed. It took nearly an hour for the medicine to work, during which time Anna bounced and wriggled, her little feet kicking their backs, and repeatedly tried to get out of bed. It was no longer endearing, and they were exhausted. Finally, at around 3 a.m., she fell asleep. But at 6:45, the alarm went off and shocked them all awake.
"I'll get her into a better routine tonight," Elaine promised as Ian struggled out of bed.
She was the main caregiver, so felt it was her responsibility. Ian was the breadwinner and had to be able to concentrate at work. An hour later, Elaine and Anna, still in their nightwear, saw Ian off at the door.
"Daddy's going to work," Elaine told her. "He'll be back this evening.
Wave goodbye."
Elaine waved, but Anna didn't. She stared after Ian, probably wondering where he was going and why. They knew it would take a few days of him going out to work and returning before Anna became familiar with their weekday routine. Elaine had a long list of things she needed to do and people to contact. Apart from unpacking and speaking to family and friends, she had to register Anna with her doctor and book an appointment for a health check as a matter of urgency. She also had to notify the authorities that Anna was in the UK, put her name on the waiting list for a nursery place, and so on. This was all in addition to spending time with Anna, playing with her and getting to know her better. For unlike a baby, Anna had come with her own character, and it was important that mother and daughter familiarized themselves with each other and got along.
"I'll be a bit busy today," Elaine told Anna, as the two of them ate breakfast together.
Ian had made himself a coffee and a slice of toast before leaving for work. She looked at Anna carefully. Thank goodness she was eating. It was a huge relief. If she'd just smile a bit more, make eye contact and want a hug occasionally, or even respond when Elaine hugged her instead of going stiff or drawing away, life would be perfect. Then she chided herself. The poor child hadn't been here for 24 hours, and prior to that there'd been so many changes that it would take time for her to adjust. Elaine would let Anna take it at her own pace. She knew from the posts on the online forum that the older the child was, the longer they needed to adjust. Children of 8 or 9, for example, sometimes took months, even years, before they were fully integrated into their adoptive family. At Anna's age, it would hopefully be a matter of weeks,
although some children adjusted straight away. It depended on their past experience, how smoothly the transition to their adoptive family had been, and the child's resilience and acceptance of all the changes. Elaine thought that Anna seemed very resilient and the adoption had gone smoothly, apart from their 3-month separation. Elaine didn't achieve as much as she'd hoped that day. It flew by in phone calls, keeping Anna occupied and their neighbour popping in to say hello and staying for an hour. Elaine did manage to make an appointment for Anna to see their doctor the following morning, but was told she'd have to register her as a temporary patient until her National Health Service number came through. Late in the afternoon, feeling she'd achieved little, Elaine tried sitting Anna in front of the children's television, but she wasn't interested. When Ian came home at 7 p.m, their cases were still unpacked. There was no dinner, and their usually tidy house looked like a whirlwind had torn through, and his wife was looking frazzled. "I was going to be so organized and have Anna in her pajamas and dinner ready when you came home, but as you can see, that hasn't happened," Elaine said apologetically. "Don't worry," Ian laughed and kissed her cheek. "It's good to be home. Why don't you get Anna ready for bed while I do us some dinner? How does spag bol sound?" "Oh, wonderful," Elaine said. "I'll be better organized tomorrow."
"Has Anna eaten?"
"Not dinner, just a snack at 4 o'clock.
"Okay, we'll all eat together. That'll be nice. There are some presents and cards in my briefcase from the guys at work. We'll have a look at them later."
"Some more cards came in the post today," Elaine said. "People are so kind and thoughtful. I've put them on the mantelpiece." Elaine felt reassured now Ian was home, and she bathed Anna and then had her in her pajamas as Ian called that dinner was ready. As they ate, she and Ian talked about their day, as they had done when Elaine had worked, only now her day was very different, and although she tried to make it sound interesting, she wasn't sure it did. Anna ate well, and when they'd finished, Ian and Elaine took her up to bed, following a similar routine to the night before. They read her a bedtime story each, then kissed her goodnight and, dimming the light, came out. Elaine waited on the landing while Ian showered, as he hadn't had a chance since returning from work. With no sleep during the day, Anna was tired and settled reasonably quickly, only getting out of bed twice before falling asleep. However, when they came up to bed at 11, they found her wide awake and sitting at the top of the stairs.
"Oh, you gave me a fright," Elaine said. "What are you doing here?"
"Goodness knows how long she's been here," she said to Ian. Elaine took her by the hand and led her back to bed, but 2 hours of sleep had rejuvenated Anna, and she was out of bed as soon as they left her room. Finally, to get some sleep, they took her into their bed again.
"I don't understand why she doesn't like her room," Elaine sighed. "It's a lovely room."
"I'm sure she does like it, but it's all new to her."
As most parents know, sleep takes on a whole new significance when deprived of it by a sleepless child, and, exhausted, they will try anything to get some sleep. Ian and Elaine put up with Anna poking and kicking them, babbling, and the lack of intimacy her presence dictated, in the hope that she would fall asleep. Eventually she did, and slept through till the alarm, so they felt some progress had been made. Anna climbed out of bed and ran round the landing to the toilet. Elaine followed her to make sure she washed her hands properly, but as she flushed the toilet, to her horror, she saw something wriggling in the pan, and her stomach churned.
"Oh, she's got worms!" she cried,
utterly repulsed. Chapter 15 Bad Parenting.
"Did you bring a stool sample with you?" the doctor asked the following morning.
"No, I'm sorry. I didn't think," Elaine said, flustered. Of course she should have thought of that.
"There are a number of different worms, and we'll treat Anna for the most common. You and your husband will need treating too."
"Really?"
"Oh, yes. Worms are highly contagious. One dose of the syrup at night. The reason you didn't see the worms before was because Anna wasn't eating properly, so they were very small. Now she's eating well, the worms have been feasting too, so have grown."
Elaine swallowed the bile rising in her throat.
"Here is the prescription,"
the doctor said, passing the printed sheet of paper to her, then recapping. The sores on her back are healing well, so keep using the cream. Her heart and lungs sound fine. She's a bit underweight, but that's only to be expected and should improve with time. Start the vitamin drops, and I've given you the form for her blood test?
Yes, Elaine said and held it up.
Take it with you to the hospital. If you go this afternoon, we should have the results back here in a week. From what you've told me, there is nothing in her or her mother's history to suggest she might have contracted a sexually transmitted disease, so the test is precautionary. The clinic for the vaccination program runs here tomorrow. I've booked her in. Is that everything?
Yes, I think so,
Elaine said, collecting together all the forms and putting them into her bag. They'd been in the surgery for ages, and Elaine knew the doctor would be running late now.
Well, good luck and congratulations, she said. You have a lovely daughter.
Thank you. Elaine felt very proud. Outside, she retrieved Anna's pushchair from the pram park at the side of the surgery, but Anna refused to get in.
It's a long walk to the pharmacy, she said, and tried to lift her in.
Anna went rigid, so it was impossible. Elaine considered persisting, but not wanting a scene in public, gave in and let Anna walk, although it was awkward manoeuvring the pushchair while holding on to her. That evening, when Ian arrived home, Elaine felt she had plenty to share about her day, and dinner was at least in the oven, although not fully cooked. Anna ate with them, and afterwards Elaine gave them all the dose of the worming medicine. It didn't taste too unpleasant. Come bedtime, Anna would only settle in their bed again with them either side of her, which meant she went to bed very late and they very early.
She must find our presence comforting, Elaine said, although Anna didn't want to cuddle, just the space between them in the bed.
If Ian reached out to hold Elaine's hand, Anna roughly pushed it away, even smacking him. They laughed and indulged Anna to begin with, but when these sleeping arrangements continued for another week, Ian complained,
"When are we going to get back to normal?"
"I'm not sure you ever do when you have children," Elaine said lightly, but she knew what he meant. They hadn't made love since the adoption. In the hotel, they'd all been in the same room, and now Anna shared their bed at night. The following night, Elaine made a big effort to settle Anna in her own room, but after a lot of screaming, which culminated in a tantrum, she gave up and let her go into their bed, by which time Ian was asleep. The blood test results came back negative, a huge relief. Anna didn't have HIV or a sexually transmitted disease, but her iron levels were a bit low, so the doctor prescribed an iron supplement. With less than 2 weeks to go before Christmas, the shops were festively decorated and full of gifts. Anna was fascinated when they went into the high street and wanted everything she saw, and then made a scene when she couldn't have them. Ian and Elaine had yet to decorate their house or buy a Christmas tree, but intended to do so the following weekend when Ian was home. Elaine was viewing Christmas with mixed feelings. Anna's first Christmas with them would obviously be very special, but she was anxious about the inevitable socializing Christmas would bring and how Anna would cope with that. Ian had wanted to accept an invitation from his brother and family to stay with them over Christmas, but Elaine had persuaded him out of it, saying it would be nice if it was just the three of them on Christmas Day. In truth, it was the thought of his brother's very well-behaved children, and she tortured herself with the look of horror on their faces if Anna played up and threw a tantrum, which Elaine would be helpless to control. When Ian came home with another invitation for them all to visit, this time from a work colleague, Elaine confided her concerns.
"Don't be silly. All kids play up sometimes," he said. "And we need to get out more. In fact, I was thinking that perhaps we could get a sitter and you and me could go out one evening. It will do us good."
"But we can't leave Anna while she's so unsettled," Elaine said, wondering why he needed to be told this.
"All right, so let's have someone round for supper like we used to."
Which they did, and it was a disaster. Anna refused to go to bed when their guests arrived and played to her new audience, interrupting, demanding attention, and babbling in her own language.
"When will she start to learn English?" one of their friends asked delicately.
"She knows a few words already," Elaine said a little defensively, aware she should have known more. When the meal was ready, Elaine tried to get Anna to bed again so the adults could eat in peace, but it proved impossible. Red-faced, Elaine set another place at the table and then watched as Ian grew increasingly agitated that the adults couldn't have a proper conversation. She was embarrassed too. When they'd been to friends' homes for supper, their children were either already in bed or went up soon after the guests arrived. When the main course was over, Elaine left them with the dessert and took Anna up to their bed, where she lay with her in the hope that she might fall asleep. Nearly an hour passed and Ian came up to find her and said their friends would be leaving shortly. Unable to face them, Elaine told him to say goodbye from her. Later, he was annoyed. "You're indulging that child too much," he said. "Anna has taken over and is ruling us. Children are supposed to fit in with their parents, not the other way round." Elaine knew he was right and felt responsible and even more of a failure. Christmas came and went, and while it wasn't the disaster Elaine had thought it might be, neither was it a joyous first family Christmas. Anna had no sense of excited expectation, looking forward to Christmas as most children do, despite taking her to see Santa and a pantomime. On Christmas Day, her face didn't light up as she opened her sack full of presents. Indeed, they couldn't get her to smile for a single photograph. Her face remained expressionless, as it was most of the time, as if she was simply going through the motions. As she had so little English, it was difficult to know what she was thinking or feeling, although Elaine formed the impression she understood far more than she let on. Anna stayed up to see in the new year. Ian opened a bottle of sparkling wine and they let Anna have one sip. A new year brings new hope, the promise of change and a fresh start. But when, 3 months later, Anna had made no progress, hadn't slept in her own bed once, and screamed non-stop if they tried to make her do something she didn't want to, defeated, Elaine took her to the doctor. "How can I help you today?" the doctor asked kindly, and Elaine burst into tears.
"I'm sorry," she said, reaching for a tissue. "It's all become too much."
The doctor waited patiently as Elaine wiped her eyes and composed herself before continuing. Anna watched her mother, emotionless.
"I don't know how we've come to this," Elaine said, taking a deep breath. "My husband and I wanted a family for so long, but I'm making a complete mess of it. We knew it wouldn't be easy, but something isn't right. We can't seem to reach her."
She glanced furtively at Anna.
"She doesn't want to be held or cuddled and barely even looks at us. When she does, there is a blankness in her eyes. She never smiles or laughs. She does exactly what she wants, when she wants, and if we try to stop her, she just screams and throws a tantrum until we give in. I've stopped going out and I hardly see anyone. I don't know what to do."
Her eyes filled again. The doctor looked at Anna thoughtfully.
"Has she learnt English?"
"Only a few words, not many. I think she understands, but won't cooperate and speak the words. Sometimes she looks at me so coldly, like she hates me, and I don't know what to do to change it."
She wiped her eyes again.
"I'm sure she doesn't hate you," the doctor reassured.
"She's only been with you 4 months. That's not long, really. I'll examine her today, and I can certainly refer her for speech therapy to help her language. But I think most of what you describe will sort itself out in time, when she's fully bonded with you and your husband.
Will she be going to nursery when she's 3?
"We haven't decided yet."
"I think it would be good for her. Mixing with other children her own age will help her language and social skills, and also give you a break."
She smiled kindly. Then to Anna she said, "Come on, let's have a look at your pet." The doctor listened to Anna's chest, looked in her ears, eyes and throat, and then, showing her a card with brightly coloured objects on it, asked her to point to the correct one.
"Dog," the doctor said.
Anna pointed to it.
"Ball."
Anna pointed.
"House,"
the doctor said, and Anna pointed to the correct object again.
"Can you say house?"
the doctor asked.
"House,"
Anna repeated.
She wouldn't do that for me, Elaine said. I knew she understood more English than she lets on.
That's children for you, the doctor said with a smile. The examination over, she returned to sit behind her desk. Anna is fine, but I'll make a referral for speech therapy to bring on her language skills. They are bound to be a bit behind those of children who have English as a first language. You'll receive an appointment in the post within a few weeks. Once she is talking more, I think life will become easier for you both. If you have any more concerns, see me again. If necessary, I can refer her to the child psychologist, but I'm sure that won't be necessary. Just give her time.
Thank you. There is one more thing, Elaine said, embarrassed to ask.
Yes?
I was wondering if you could prescribe a sedative for Anna to make her sleep at night.
Why? Isn't she sleeping?
Yes, but she will only sleep in our bed.
The doctor smiled. Most children of her age would prefer to sleep in their parents' bed if allowed. You will have to be firm to get her back into sleeping in her own bed. Does she have her own bedroom?
Yes.
Good. Establish a bedtime routine with a bath and story, then settle her in her own bed. Say good night and come out. If she gets out of bed, which she will do to begin with, take her back. You may have to return her many times until she learns, but she will learn. I'm speaking from experience. My son went through a phase of wanting to sleep with us. It took my husband and me a full week of taking him back before he learned. Elaine nodded politely, but didn't dare say Anna had never slept in her own bed, not once. Here are the names of some good websites that give parenting advice, the doctor said, winding up and passing her a printed sheet. You use a computer?
Yes, thank you, Elaine said, tucking the paper into her bag.
You're welcome. Elaine left the surgery, reassured by the referral for speech therapy, but aware that she and Ian were going to have to be firmer with Anna, although she wasn't sure how. Perhaps the websites would help. 4 months later, she returned in tears and begged that Anna be referred to a child psychologist. The situation had deteriorated further, and now aged 3, Anna had been excluded from nursery for repeatedly hitting and biting other children.
Part 2 Chapter 16 Foster Care
Kathy, she has had 2 foster carers since coming into care a week ago, Jill said.
You're joking!
I wish I was. She can't be moved again.
No, indeed.
Jill was my supervising social worker, also known as a support or link worker from the agency I fostered for. It was early afternoon and Jill had telephoned me with some details of a 5-year-old girl the social services wanted me to foster. It was shocking that the poor child had had to move twice since coming into care. It's unsettling enough for a child to have to leave home to live with carers without having to move carers 3 times if she came to me.
What went wrong?
I asked, aware that something must have happened to necessitate the moves. The first carers were very experienced and were already fostering a baby. Anna kept trying to tip the baby out of its pram and cot. They had to watch her continuously and felt the placement had become unmanageable, so they asked for her to be moved. Although the second carers didn't have young children, they were newly approved to foster and were horrified when Anna was cruel to their cat and kept throwing it downstairs. They tried sanctioning her, but this morning, after another incident, they asked for her to be moved today.
Jill, we have a cat, I said somberly.
I know.
At her age, she should know it's wrong to treat a baby or cat like that, I said, concerned.
While a toddler might tip a baby out of a pram or throw a cat and not appreciate the significance or the harm they could do, a 5-year-old certainly should know.
Anna has been diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder, Jill said. As you know from your foster carer training, it is thought to be responsible for a lot of behavioural problems.
So, is she seeing a child psychologist then?
She has been, but not at present, although the school want a referral again.
They have raised concerns about Anna's behaviour since she started school, and she only attends part-time.
Why part-time?
She wasn't coping. There were a number of incidents, so rather than exclude her, they have reduced her hours.
Which school does she go to?
Jill told me, and I knew where the school was, on the other side of town.
We will need to move her later today, Jill said. The only other carer we have free is newly approved. We can't send her there.
No, that's for sure. Clearly, Anna had very challenging behaviour, so she needed to be placed with an experienced carer who would hopefully have the resources and strategies to manage and improve it. I was experienced, but I was hesitating, because we'd just said goodbye the day before to a boy with very challenging behaviour. Was it fair on my children, Adrian, aged 8, and Paula, 4, to look after another child straight away with similar or worse behaviour? Foster carers are expected to take the child referred to them unless there is a very good reason why they can't. That I had just fostered a child with behavioural difficulties wasn't sufficient reason to refuse, nor that I was a single parent and we had a cat.
Has she been in care before? I asked, hedging for time.
No. The social worker will fill you in on the details once you agree to take her. I do know that Anna is an only child and has generally been well cared for, although the parents sought help for her behaviour when she was about 3. That's when the psychologist was first involved. 10 days ago, her mother telephoned the social services distraught and said she couldn't cope with her any longer. Apparently, her husband left them just after Christmas, and Anna's behaviour has deteriorated further since then.
It was that piece of information that swayed me. I knew what it felt like to have your husband walk out, leaving you to face the future alone. The hurt and pain and crushing blow to your self-confidence. My husband had left me 3 years before for another woman, and back then I had wondered how I would cope alone. Then I found the resources. My children didn't have behavioural problems, but without doubt, for a mother who was already struggling with her child's behaviour, being left alone would be the final blow.
"Okay, what time will Anna be here?" I asked. "I'll need to collect Adrian and Paula from school later."
"I'll find out and get back to you. Thanks, Kathy."
Just to be clear, I could have refused to take Anna. Foster carers can't be forced into looking after a child, but there is the expectation that they will. If I hadn't taken her, then very likely, rather than place her with inexperienced carers locally, the social services would have sent her out of the area for the care she needed. That would have created more disruption for the child, including a change of school or long car journeys to and from her present school. I hadn't asked about contact arrangements. The social worker would tell me later. Most children who come into care see their parents regularly. Neither had Jill told me what the care plan was, that is, the long-term plan for Anna, but from what I knew so far, I assumed she would eventually be going home. I went upstairs to check the spare bedroom, shortly to be Anna's room, mulling over what I knew about reactive attachment disorder, RAD. It is a rare but serious condition found in children who have never bonded with their parents or main caregiver, usually as a result of severe neglect or abuse, although that didn't seem to be the case here. Jill had said Anna had been generally well looked after. RAD varies in severity and often becomes most noticeable around the ages of 5 and 6, when the child's already worrying behaviour spirals out of control. They often appear cold, uncaring, and without conscience, remorse, empathy, or trust, and are unable to form normal, loving relationships. They are angry, destructive, defiant, manipulative, and cruel, and can steal and lie for their own ends, and appear not to care about the consequences. Name a negative behaviour, and it'll come up under reactive attachment disorder, although some of these behaviours can be found in other conditions too. However, so great is the RAD child's lack of emotion and conscience that on a brain scan there is a dark mass where their emotion should be. If left untreated, the condition can go with the child into adulthood, creating cold and calculating adults who show no remorse and are unable to form relationships. The good news is that a child with RAD can improve dramatically with therapy, but in order to do so, The child needs to be in a secure, stable and loving relationship with their parent or main caregiver, which clearly Anna wasn't. I checked the bedroom. It was fine. Aware that it probably wouldn't be long before it would be needed again, I changed the bedding and given it a good clean the day before, straight after the lad I'd been fostering had left. With 70,000 children in care in the UK and more coming in each day, there is a permanent shortage of foster carers and beds are never empty for long. As I neared the bottom of the stairs, the phone rang. I answered it in the hall. It was Jill. "I've spoken to Anna's social worker, Laurie, and she'll be going to collect Anna soon and will bring her to you. I've told her you need to pick up your children from school, so she'll be with you when you get back around 4 o'clock. I'll arrive 10 minutes before." "Thank you, Jill. If Laurie needs to talk to you without Anna present, I'll keep her amused in another room." "Thanks," I said again. A good supervising social worker is invaluable in fostering. They know their carers and look out for them, offering support, advice and practical help when necessary. All I needed to do now was to tell Adrian and Paula that Anna would be coming to stay with us.
"Good. A girl my age," Paula predictably said, viewing Anna as a playmate. She and her brother Adrian, who was 4 years older, often played nicely together, but it's a bonus to have someone of a similar age to play with.
"Okay," Adrian said with a shrug.
We were walking from school.
"But I need to watch something on television at 5 o'clock. Our teacher said we have to. It's about the Tudors."
This wasn't as random as it sounded. Our television is in the living room, where the adults would be while Laurie, Anna's social worker, placed her, a process that Adrian knew would take an hour or possibly longer.
"I'll set the recorder so you can watch it later," I said.
"Why is she in care?" Adrian asked.
"I'm not sure of all the details, but her mother was struggling with her behaviour and needed some help." A direct question deserved an honest answer, but I didn't expand on this with talk about RAD and two carers unable to contain Anna's behaviour. It could have worried Adrian and also prejudiced him and Paula against Anna. I would deal with her behaviour as it arose, although to be honest, I wasn't as confident as I might have sounded. Yes, I'd dealt with challenging behaviour before in children I'd fostered, but then it had been one of a number of concerns about the child. For example, a teenager who'd gone off the rails, experimenting with drink and drugs and getting into trouble with the police. To be fostering a child of 5 who'd had to leave her parents and 2 carers purely because of behaviour was a first for me. Once home, we just had time for a drink before Jill arrived. She said hello to Adrian and Paula, and they disappeared up to their rooms to play. They'd come down when Anna and her social worker arrived. I made Jill a cup of coffee and we sat in the living room. As for my supervising social worker, in addition to offering support and advice, she also attended meetings with me and was usually present when a child was placed.
"Do we know any more about Anna's background?" I asked as she sipped her coffee.
"No, because she's been moved as an emergency, the referral was sparse."
I nodded. Had Anna come to me with more notice, as a planned move, I would have had more details and very likely Anna would have been able to visit us before the move, so we weren't complete strangers to her. As it was, she'd meet us and see the house as she moved in, which wasn't ideal, but couldn't be avoided.
Jill and I chatted for a few minutes about another child I'd fostered a few years back and who was doing well. Foster carers are always pleased to hear news about the children they've looked after, even if it's a long time ago. We never forget them. Just after 4 o'clock, the doorbell rang and I felt my heart step up a beat as I stood to answer it. I'm often slightly anxious before a new child arrives, wondering if they will like us and what I'll be able to do to help them, but I now had the additional worry of Anna's behaviour. Taking a deep breath, I opened the front door.
"Hello, love. You must be Anna," I said with a smile, and wondered what all the fuss was about.
Slightly built, with clear blue eyes and fair hair neatly trimmed to chin level, she looked as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. Her gaze went past me and down the hall.
"Hello, I'm Laurie,"
her social worker said, coming in. We shook hands. In her late 30s, she was dressed smart casual in a jumper and trousers and a warm winter jacket. I'll need a hand bringing in her cases later, she said. Sure. It's usual to get all the paperwork done first and then bring in the child's belongings at the end, before the social worker says goodbye and leaves. Laurie automatically slipped off her jacket and hung it on the hall stand and left her shoes with ours. Shall we take off your coat and boots? I said to Anna. She looked at her boots as though considering this, then took off her coat, which I hung on the stand. They're nice warm boots, I said. Leave them in the hall with ours. Which she did. We always take off our outdoor shoes when coming in for good hygiene, and I encourage others to do the same. Jill's here, I said to Laurie. Come through. I led the way down the hall and into the living room. This is my supervising social worker, Jill, I explained to Anna. Hi, Anna, Jill said with a smile. How are you? Anna glanced at Jill but didn't smile or acknowledge her in any way, just turned her head to look around the room. Jill and Laurie said hello. They knew each other from working together before. Do you want to play with the toys while we talk? Laurie asked Anna, referring to the toy boxes I'd put out. Apparently she didn't, for Anna went to the sofa and sat down. Laurie sat beside her while Jill and I took the easy chairs. Nice long garden to play in when it's warmer, Laurie said to Anna, glancing through the patio windows and trying to put her at ease. Or if it snows, I said, hoping to capture Anna's interest. She glanced at me, but her face was expressionless and cool. I formed the impression she kept her feelings very well hidden, which could be part of R.A.D. Having heard the doorbell, Adrian and Paula now came downstairs and I introduced them. Paula looked hopefully at Anna, wondering if she wanted to play, while Adrian looked pointedly at the clock. I've set the recorder for your program, I told him. Having said hi to Anna, he left. There was no need for him to stay. There'd be plenty of time for them to get to know each other later when the formalities were over. Paula was still looking hopefully towards Anna. Not only were they of a similar age, but a similar build, too. Would you like to play with Paula? I asked Anna. No, Anna said. It was the first word she'd spoken. Okay, maybe later then, I said, and threw Paula an encouraging smile. She appreciated that when a child first arrived, it could take a while for them to find the confidence to start playing and talking. Paula sat by the toy box and began taking out its contents as Anna watched. I didn't think it would be long before she joined in. Anna is in care under a Section 20, Laurie began, adjusting the paperwork on her lap. It was at her mother's request. A Section 20 of the Children's Act is also known as accommodated, and is when a parent or parents ask for or agree to their child going into care voluntarily. There is no court case, and they retain parental rights. Anna has been diagnosed with an attachment disorder, Laurie continued. I haven't read the full report yet, but it's thought it was a result of her early years experience. She was in and out of a state orphanage in... She named the country... for the first 2 years of her life before she was adopted. We now know that the level of care in some of those orphanages was inadequate, and children were left for hours in their cots without any stimulation, and their cries for help went unanswered. As a result, they can fail to trust adults or form loving relationships, and it comes out later in their behaviour. I saw Jill looking uncomfortably at Anna, as indeed I was. Laurie was talking about her in quite personal detail in front of her. Laurie, Jill said, would it be helpful for you to talk to Kathy about the history in another room? I can stay here with Anna and Paula. It's okay, Laurie said easily. Anna is aware of her history. She's grown up knowing the circumstances of her early years and that she has a birth mother and was adopted. Clearly it was Laurie's decision. Anna remained expressionless, watching Paula. Anna goes to school, Laurie continued, naming her school, but she is on reduced hours at present, 10 o'clock till 2. She is with her class in the morning for lessons with support, has lunch with the rest of the school, then has a small group activity with a teaching assistant in the afternoon. You are able to take her to and from school? Laurie now asked me.
Yes.
Foster carers are expected to take the children they look after to and from school, contact, and any appointments they may have. Sometimes it's quite a juggling act if you have school-aged children yourself, but Anna's reduced timetable would help. I would be able to take Adrian and Paula to school first, and then Anna to hers, and do the reverse at the end of the day.
The school arrangements will be reviewed, but they seem to be working at present,
Laurie continued. The school has asked for a referral to the child psychologist, although there is a waiting list. I'll have to arrange an LAC, looked after children, review. I'll let you know the date. Here is the essential information form, part one. She handed Jill and me a copy. This form contained the basic information about the child I was fostering, which I needed to help me look after the child. As well as their name, home address, date of birth, and names of their parents, it included any other family members, and I read that Anna had no siblings. Her ethnicity was given as British, and her language English. The box for religion showed nominally Church of England.
"Does she go to church?" I asked.
"Not as far as I know," Laurie said. I continued a quick read-through, as Jill did. The legal status showed Section 20, which Laurie had already covered. There were no special dietary requirements and no known allergies. In the box asking if there was any challenging behaviour, yes, attachment disorder had been printed. Besides special educational needs were the hours she went to school and that she had support from a teaching assistant. The box for contact arrangements was blank.
"Do you know the contact arrangements now?" Jill asked, just as I was about to.
I reached for a pen, ready to make a note.
"There aren't any," Laurie said.
Jill and I looked at her.
"Why not?"
Jill asked, as surprised as I was. It wasn't Laurie who answered, but Anna.
"I don't want to see my mother, and she doesn't want to see me,"
she said, cold as ice. Chapter 17. First Night. "Her mother is going through a difficult time at present," Laurie said, trying to smooth over Anna's harsh words. "I'll be seeing her again shortly, so hopefully she will feel a bit stronger."
"What about telephone contact?" Jill asked.
"Not at present, and I'm trying to trace Anna's father."
"I don't want to see him either,"
Anna said, her face hard. Paula looked over, thinking she must have misheard. Although her father no longer lived with us, she and Adrian saw him regularly.
"What is the care plan?" Jill asked, moving on.
"I'll send you both a copy," Laurie said. "We were hoping for rehabilitation home." But I heard her doubt. Without regular contact, there was little chance of Anna returning home. Anna, who'd been eyeing Paula closely, suddenly stood and went to her. I assumed, as I think Jill and Laurie did, that she was going to play with her, but instead she roughly snatched the toy Paula was holding and returned to her seat without saying a word.
"Paula was playing with that," I said. "There are plenty more farmyard animals in the toy box."
I went to Paula, who was looking shocked and rather hurt, and taking a handful of toy animals from the toy box, placed them in her lap. "You play with those," I said. It wasn't the time to explain to Anna why you didn't snatch a toy from another child and persuade her to hand it back. That would come later.
"You have to ask if you want a toy someone else has,"
Jill said to Anna as I returned to my seat.
"She hasn't learned about sharing yet," Laurie said. "The school has been working on it."
I nodded. Paula had her head bowed, looking at the toys in her lap, but Anna was staring at her unabashed, gloating and victorious. Clearly she had a lot to learn when it came to sharing and mixing with other children. Laurie checked through her notes.
"Have I missed anything?" she asked, glancing at Jill and me. "I've placed Anna 3 times in a week, so I'm not sure who I've said what to."
"Can you let us both know the date of the review when you've arranged it?" Jill asked, "so I can put it in my diary and attend."
"Yes, of course."
Laurie made a note, and then returned her papers to her bag-cum-briefcase.
"Shall we look around the house now, and then we'll unpack the car?"
We all stood, and Paula came to my side, not wanting to be left alone.
"This is the living room," I said to Anna and Laurie, beginning the tour. Jill knew my house well. "We are usually in here in the evenings, playing a game, reading, or watching television."
"That's nice," Laurie said encouragingly.
Anna looked back, expressionless. I led the way into our kitchen come dining room.
"This is where we eat," I said, pointing to the table in the dining area.
Tosha, our cat, having heard people in the kitchen and aware it was nearly dinner time, came in through the cat flap. Paula went over and stroked her and was rewarded with a loud meow. Aware of the cat's fate in the last foster home Anna had lived in, I watched her carefully, but her face was blank. She made no move towards Tosha to stroke or pet her as most children would.
"She's very friendly," I said. "Do you like cats?"
Anna shook her head.
"The one before scratched me, so I threw it downstairs," she said, unabashed.
"Tosha doesn't scratch or bite, but even if she did, we wouldn't throw her. That would be unkind."
Paula joined me again as we went out, down the hall and into the front room.
"This is like a quiet room," I said to Anna, "if you want to be alone."
It held the computer, sound system, shelves of books, a cabinet with a lockable drawer where I kept important documents, and a small table and chairs. It tended to be used more by teenagers who wanted their own space, rather than children of Anna's age.
"Very good," Jill said, although she'd seen it all before.
Upstairs I showed Anna her room first, at the rear of the house, and overlooking the garden.
"It'll feel more comfortable once you have your things in here," I said encouragingly.
Laurie agreed, but Anna met our comments and her new room with the same indifference, although I suspected there was plenty going on in her thoughts. "You don't leave your mother and then have to change home 3 times in a week and come out unscathed." I now led our little group into the bathroom.
"Anna has good self-care skills," Laurie said.
"Excellent," I said, smiling at Anna. "We usually have our baths in the evening before we go to bed." She was unimpressed.
I briefly showed her my bedroom.
"This is where I sleep. If you need me in the night, call out and I'll come to you."
I then led the way along the landing to Paula's room. I opened the bedroom door just wide enough so Anna and Laurie could look in and then closed it again.
"We all have our own bedrooms and they are private," I told Anna, as I told all the children when they first arrived. "We don't go into each other's bedrooms unless we are asked to, and we always knock first if we want the person."
To demonstrate, I now knocked on Adrian's bedroom door.
"Hi, can I show Anna and Laurie your room, please?" I said.
"Yes, come in," came his reply.
I opened the door so they could see in. Adrian was sitting on the floor playing with some toys.
"Thank you, Adrian,"
Laurie said and closed the door as they came out.
"It might take Anna a while to get used to living here," Laurie commented as we returned downstairs. "There was just her and her parents at home, so they didn't need much privacy."
"Don't worry, I know it takes time to settle in," I said, "but I think it helps if the ground rules are explained at the start."
"Absolutely," Jill agreed. "Then everyone knows what's expected of them."
"We'll bring your bags in now,"
Laurie said to Anna as we arrived in the hall.
"Can I help?"
Paula asked, wanting to stay close to me.
"Yes, of course."
I took her coat from the hall stand and passed it to her.
"I'm not helping," Anna said firmly.
"No, you can come with me. We'll play with some toys in the living room," Jill said positively.
Touching Anna's shoulder, she steered her down the hall.
"There are a lot of bags,"
Laurie warned me as we slipped on our coats and shoes.
"No worries, I can store what Anna doesn't need."
Although it was unusual for a child who'd only been in care a week to come with a lot of luggage. More often, the parents are reluctant to part with their child's belongings, as it's an upsetting confirmation that they are in care and no longer living with them. Then, usually after the social worker explains it's better for the child to have their own things rather than use the carer's, they gradually bag it up and pass it on a little at a time over months, often at contact. Paula and I followed Laurie out to her car. It was dark now in winter and the air cold. When Laurie opened the car, an estate, and the interior lights went on, I saw what she meant by a lot. The boot, part of the back seat, and the front passenger seat were full of cases, bags, and boxes.
"I think her mother packed everything except her bike," Laurie said. "Most of it hasn't been unpacked. She wasn't with the other carers long enough."
I took a small child's handbag from the boot and gave it to Paula to take in while Laurie and I loaded ourselves with as much as we could carry. We went back and forth, and as her car slowly emptied and my hall and front room filled, my concerns deepened. This wasn't the luggage of a child who was coming into care for a few weeks or months to give her mother a break, but one who was going away for good.
"What are the chances of Anna returning home?" I asked Laurie quietly as we took in the last of the bags.
"Not good," she said. "We're looking for the father, and if he can't look after her, then kinship carers, family members. Anna's mother has a sister, and her father has a married brother who may be willing to offer Anna a home. Failing that, she will be in long-term foster care." I'd just shut the front door when I heard Paula cry out from the living room simultaneously with Jill's voice saying, "No, Anna, that was naughty!" Paula, visibly upset, ran into the hall and to me. Jill appeared behind her.
"Sorry, Kathy. Anna pushed her. She thought she'd taken her bag."
"It's all right," I said, consoling Paula. I went into the living room where Anna was standing, clutching the bag.
"Anna, I gave Paula that bag to carry in. She was helping me, not taking it from you."
"Don't care," she said defiantly. "It's mine."
Again, I didn't say anything further for now, as Laurie was about to say goodbye and leave, but it was another small incident that showed how watchful I was going to have to be. It was set to get much worse. Uncooperative and confrontational aren't words I like to use about any child, but that's what Anna was that evening. Usually there is what foster carers refer to as a honeymoon period when a child first moves in. Regardless of any negative behavior that might have gone before, when they first arrive, they are usually on their best behavior. It can last for days, weeks, even months. Then they relax, feel more secure, and start to push the boundaries as a way of testing the carer's commitment to them. Anna clearly hadn't heard of honeymoon period and was determined to make herself as unpleasant as possible from the start, and who could blame her? In her eyes, she'd been rejected 3 times in a week and must have felt unloved and very angry. After Laurie and Jill had left, Adrian came downstairs to see if he could watch the television program about the Tudors I'd recorded.
"Yes, good idea," I said. "You can watch it while I make dinner."
"I don't want to watch it,"
Anna said, without even knowing what it was. Adrian hesitated.
"What do you normally do in the evenings?" I asked her, wanting to accommodate her wishes if possible.
"Watch television," she said, "but not the one you want."
"So what do you like to watch?" I asked. She shrugged. As she had no preference, I didn't see why Adrian shouldn't watch the program he needed to. I explained to Anna that it was for school, and that if she didn't want to watch it, she could play with some toys. The program was only 20 minutes long. I set the recorder to play and waited until Anna was settled by the toy box.
"I'll be in the kitchen if anyone wants me," I said.
I went out with Paula, leaving the doors between the living room and kitchen open so I could hear what was going on. For a few minutes, all that could be heard was the television. Then Adrian came in.
"Mum, Anna keeps standing in front of the television so I can't see it."
Leaving what I was doing, I went into the living room where Anna was now sitting by the toy box again.
"Try not to stand in front of the television," I said.
"I didn't,"
she replied confrontationally.
"Good. I'm pleased."
I waited until she was playing again and returned to the kitchen with Paula at my side. A couple of minutes later, Adrian appeared again with the same complaint. I went into the living room.
"Anna, I have asked you not to stand in front of the television, love. Adrian can't see it. It would be a great pity if I had to tell you off on your first night here."
She shrugged. I waited until she was occupied again and returned to the kitchen. It was getting late and I needed to make us dinner. It wasn't long before Adrian appeared again.
Mum, I'll watch the programme later. She keeps humming so I can't hear it properly. I'm sorry, love.
He went up to his room while I went into the living room and switched off the television.
I want to watch it,
Anna demanded. So did Adrian, but you stopped him from doing so.
I want to watch something else.
No, love, that wouldn't be fair when you stopped Adrian from watching. She looked mildly surprised, as though she really thought she would get her own way, but this was about fairness, and if I didn't put in place what was acceptable now, it would be more difficult later. The maxim, start as you mean to go on, is very true.
Hate you,
she said, then screwed up her face, opened her mouth wide, and screamed for all she was worth. It was truly ear-piercing. Paula fled to her room while I put my hands over my ears and waited for it to pass. Perhaps she thought screaming would change my mind, or possibly it was an expression of rage. Finally, red in the face, she ran out of breath and stopped.
Hate you,
she said again, narrowing her eyes. I can understand why you might, I said evenly, going to her. You must be feeling very hurt and alone from all the moves and not living with your mother. Would you like to tell me about how you're feeling and have a hug?
No,
she scowled. Sure, she stuck out her tongue. Another time, then. You can play with the toys. I'll be in the kitchen if you want me. I returned to making the dinner, popping into the living room every so often to check on her. I heard Paula cross the landing and go into Adrian's room, where they stayed playing until I called everyone for dinner. I fetched Anna, who hadn't immediately come, and showed her where her place was at the table. We tended to keep to the same places. She shook her head and said she didn't want to sit at the table but wanted her dinner on a tray in front of the television. I explained that we sat at the table to eat, and anyway the television was staying off for now.
My mummy lets me,
she said, jutting out her chin defiantly. That's her decision, I said. Here, we eat at the table. Foster carers are expected to take meals at a table, as it encourages good eating habits, and the evening meal is often the only time the whole family sits down together. Adrian and Paula were looking at Anna anxiously, clearly wondering if this was going to develop into another screaming fit, but I think she was too hungry. She sat in the chair I showed her, and as soon as I set her plate in front of her, she picked up her knife and fork and began eating.
I don't like this,
she said partway through, but eating it nonetheless. What do you like? I asked. I can get some in for another time. Foster carers try to accommodate a child's food preferences and stick to their routines at home as much as possible, but that relies on the parent or parents passing these details to the carer, which hadn't happened here yet.
Biscuits,
Anna said.
I like biscuits.
Okay, you can have a biscuit when you've finished your main course.
I don't want your biscuits. You won't have the ones I want.
I might, I said. I'll show you what we have when we've finished. She looked a little confused, but continued with her meal. Once we'd finished, I showed her our selection of biscuits, but she shook her head and looked genuinely disappointed. Do you know what the biscuits are called and I can buy some? I said.
You can't get them here. Mummy tried, but they are too far away.
It was my turn to look confused. So where did you have these biscuits?
In the hotel.
When you were on holiday?
No, in my country,
she said, as though I should have understood. Your country? She nodded.
When I was adopted.
Oh, I see, I smiled. You've got a good memory. You were only little then.
Mummy tells me, and we have photos we look at.
That's nice. I was pleased Anna had shared this with me, but surprised the memory was so alive with so much going on at present. It was getting late, and I always like to round off the day with a story or game before I take the children up for their baths and bed. So, leaving the washing up, I ushered everyone into the living room. Anna didn't want to listen to a story or play any game Adrian, Paula, or I suggested, so I told her to fetch one of hers for us all to play. Her luggage was where I'd left it. I hadn't had a chance to unpack, but I'd seen plenty of toys and games in the boxes. I went with her, and as she searched for what she wanted, I saw that the bags had cardboard luggage tags attached to the handles, labelled either by Anna's mother or one of the carers, stating what the bag contained, which was helpful. I placed the bag marked nighttime clothes and school uniform at the foot of the stairs ready to go up. The rest I would sort out.